travel to Carter Hall, for young Tamlin is there.
The Strains of Tamlin there, performed of course by Fairport Convention on their seminal 1969 album Lesion Leaf. To so many people, this was a way into the world of traditional music. Although many who heard it would be unsure of its origins, I'm sure, or even that it might sound so different in so many alternative versions. Welcome to the second episode of the Old Songs podcast. This week we're chatting about Tamlin, or Rowd 35, Child 39, to give it its official numbers. And it was chosen for this episode by one of the most boundary-pushing exponents of the genre, Mr. Jim Murray. Now, Jim has been exploring modern ways to get in and around traditional music for around two decades, and he's known for his ability to combine the old with the decidedly new. So, it was fascinating that he chose what is arguably one of the oldest songs in the archives to hone in on, although we shall see whether he thinks it deserves its old song status, even slightly, very shortly. Over the course of several hot drinks, the conversation rambled across the editing of folk songs, the motives behind the collection of these songs, what Jim would like to be known for as a singer of traditional songs himself, and he also touched on the idea that pre-internet times it was very easy to make claims about where you got an old song from without anyone questioning things too much. So we'll go into that in a moment. And then there's the small subject of what I'm hoping might become something of a tradition here on the Old Songs podcast. Early in the conversation, Jim discusses the fact that he's never recorded a version of Tamlin. And he also mentions that he doesn't think he'll do it until he's much older. Well, in the weeks that followed, we chatted about the possibility of him recording an unaccompanied version, in much the same way that Nick Hart did with Henry Martin in episode 1. And I have to say, I tried very hard to underline the fact that there was no pressure for him to do so, but clearly his sense of competition was triggered. So, it gives me great delight to be able to say that you'll find Jim Murray's unaccompanied version of Tamlin, by no means the most definitive version, he'll do that later in his career of course, right at the end of this podcast. So, without further ado, let's get stuck right into the podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, allow me to introduce Jim Murray discussing Tamlin. Wow, this is a huge one. Tamlin.
Yeah, I thought we'd go hard or go home.
Yeah, absolutely. we should start for non-folkies by saying that Tamlin is not a flu medication.
From searching Spotify, I found that there's a country singer called Tammy Lynn as well.
Oh, really?
T-A-M-I Lynn.
Right, okay.
L-Y-N. So that got a bit confusing.
Yeah, and as I'm sure we'll come across, there's an Irish version of this song called Brian Lynn. And
right,
just on the off
yes.
chance, one of my good friends is called Brian Lynn, so okay. That threw me a little.
Yeah.
But I've told him to go off this morning and go and sort of study his own past through epic ballads.
Study his past and see if he's a half-elf. Yeah.
We'll come on to what Tamlin is in a minute, other than to say that, according to many, it's one, possibly, arguably, one of the oldest folk songs we know about,
yeah.
But you think that's a contentious thing, so we'll come back to that. So, yeah, you said it's Child 39. And
Child 39.
And actually, Rowd 35. So
right, okay. So pretty early in Steve's system.
That's right.
Because as I understand it, you probably know more about this than me, having spoken to him. But as I understand it, Steve Rowd's classifying of things is the order in which he got interested in them.
That seems to be it. I mean,
like, number one is because that was the one that grabbed his attention first.
Yeah.
And then as he thought of more, he added them to the list.
So, I don't think there's any more rhyme and reason to it than that.
No.
I think it's what went into his shoebox under his bed.
Yes.
In which or whatever order he happened to come across them. And I've talked about who Steve Rowd is in some of the other podcasts already, so we don't really have to cover him again. But Child is an interesting one here. And also what I think is quite interesting about Tamlin is that we're talking about two different types of song collecting. Because if you take that Child, I think, collected 14
Francis J. Child collected 14 versions of Tamlin, as I understand it.
Right, yes.
And he did it all by sitting at his New Hampshire desk and sending out letters to people.
Yeah, collecting in a different sense to the way that we use the term. So, I mean, I suppose for non-folk people listening to this, when you hear people talking about folk song collectors, the model for that is somebody like Cecil Sharp or George Gardner or Frank Kidston around Leeds, who were going out trying to find old people who knew some old songs.
Yeah.
Really? Mm. And in Cecil Sharp's case, you know, riding on his bicycle, going door to door, knocking, asking if anybody knew anybody who knew any old songs.
Extraordinary.
And a child was a different kind of collector, as you say, sending letters out and having things sent to him. It was far more people sending him things that they knew he'd be interested in, him pasting them in his scrapbook or whatever. But I didn't know at first that Child was the first professor of English at Harvard University, which sort of explains a lot. So his ideas were based on... His ideas were all based around sort of creative writing and epic poems and, you know, he was an English language and English literature scholar. But that, you know, that's why there's no tunes in the Child Ballads. They're there as, you know, as a sort of epic poetry.
Yes,
like there. Studying Beowulf or something.
Yeah. And so, so he would send these letters. I read this morning that he sent out thousands of letters, and to Scotland alone sent out 2,500 letters.
Okay.
And he would just send them to communities who then presumably somebody's going to go on into the community from that letter and collect it and send back.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I mean, I don't know so much about that process that he went through. One of the things that comes into folk song collecting is trying to untangle people's motives. And that's sort of been folk academia of the last 30 years, 35, 40 years maybe. That wave of folk song collecting in the early 1900s, I think, taps into a whole... There was a sort of nationalist movement in all forms of art at that time.
William Morris.
Pre-First World War, it was this idea of... So Bartok in Hungary wanting to write quintessentially Hungarian music and trying to learn more about how to do that by going and collecting folk music from Hungary.
Yeah.
So people like Vaughan Williams or Delius or Percy Grainger wanted to write quintessentially English music by going and trying to find what English people sang and what makes, you know, what defines Englishness.
Yeah.
They are the same ideas of nationalism that tap into sort of that feed into wars and the darker stuff.
Yeah, of course.
But I suppose I envisage it as being this time before it all went bad. But it's the same. It's the same sort of impulse.
Yeah.
Of what makes these people different from outsiders.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Folk academia of the last sort of 35, 40 years has been quite untangling those impulses and going to try and find stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a famous book by a man called Dave Harker called Fake Song, which goes through waves of people thinking he had a point, but it was very sort of anti Sharp,
right?
Pretty
yeah.
much. I haven't finished reading Fake Song. I have to admit, because it took me quite a long time to get a copy of it on Amazon Marketplace, but I have one now. So so come back Christmas to me in a bit reading. About that. But it's quite a controversial book. And similarly, there is a book called Georgina Boys called The Imagined Village.
Yep.
After which the band The Imagined Village took their name. But one of the tenets of that book is that the folk song collectors had this idea of what they wanted to discover before they went out looking for it.
Yes, okay.
So somebody like Cecil Sharp had this idea in his head of this rural idyll where songs were sung around the village green and it was just waiting there to be discovered. And he went with a very clear idea of what he wanted to find.
Yes, quite, yeah.
And then anything that didn't fit that or was complicated or anything that was nuanced or messy or fuzzy sort of got written out of it.
Right.
And this isn't Sharp specifically. This is... the folk song collecting, the first folk song revival.
Yes.
And anything that was complicated and hard to understand sort of got left behind or, you know, or tidied up or made to make sense by bending the facts a little bit.
Yeah.
So what I've found is that the more you dig away at folk music, the less certain things become. Trying to untangle Sharp's motives in collecting things is something that's occupied a lot of very clever people for the last sort of 30 or 40 years. This ballad is a big one for several reasons, I think.
So the reasons that I think it's probably, I mean, certainly I was delighted when you suggested that this is what you wanted to talk about. Well, there's a few reasons, actually. One is that it's got some really definitive recordings of it. And in some ways, I'm certainly thinking of the Fairport Convention one.
Yeah.
For many people, it's another gateway song into folk music.
Yeah, I suppose it is. I'd not thought about that.
Because it's accessible in the
It's
certainly in the Fairport version. And then as you get more used to traditional singing and you're more comfortable with the idea of unaccompanied singing, there are versions, I'm thinking particularly of Mike Waterson and Frankie Armstrong, that are fairly definitive versions of perhaps how a ballad might ought to be sung unaccompanied.
Yeah.
Well, but the other thing that interested me was that actually, as far as I know it, you haven't recorded this in your...
No, I haven't. As you say, I think it's a monumental one for lots of reasons. And it's monumental for me because I find the process the song has been through chimes with a lot of things that I've found about folk song in general. So it's quite a good way of talking about lots of things about traditional music all at once. But yeah, you're right. I think those definitive versions cast a really long shadow.
We'll come back to that. Let's start with what the song is.
Oh, okay. Come all you maids and you very pretty maids, a warning take by me. Don't go down to the chaser's wood. If a maid you want to return, return. If a maid you want to return.
An interesting thing that I read the other day is that Frankie Armstrong sung this song for at least 30 years and still wasn't really sure what she was singing about by the end of it. It's just such a huge subject and narrative and that kind of thing. But it seems to have been, you know, from what I can see, and you feel free to jump in, correct me, the ballad, the earliest recording, and by which I mean it being taken down rather than actually recorded on vinyl or anything like that, the earliest recording seems to be about 1549.
I've heard a reference to that.
And that's...
But I've read other references that... Because... So one of the things that about folk music that gets to me, is it's quite easy to kid yourself that things are really, really old sometimes, which isn't to say that they're not.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think within the second folk revival, what we would call the second folk revival, which happens from the late 50s-ish, probably to now, people would include that, although that's another story. there's a lot of romanticising things in ways of like... I think especially pre-internet days when it was harder to look things up, there's a lot of characters who were quite flamboyant and quite happy to just drop this song is 1,000 years old. When you scratch away at the surface, quite a lot of songs you find were maybe collected in 1908-ish and were 40 years old at that point.
Right, yeah, yeah.
There are things that are documented a lot further back than that, but very few that are more than a few hundred years old. So yeah, I've heard that this song is referred to.
Yeah.
So in fact, quite often when things are 400-500 years old.
Yeah.
It's that there's a record of a song being sung by that title.
Right.
But no record of the song. And the earliest time there's any lyrics or melody would be the mid-1800s.
Yeah, yeah.
So this song, I would guess, falls into that category, although I think the words as a poem are a lot older.
Yeah, so the few little details that I've managed to garner. It turns up as a reference in a book called The Complaint of Scotland.
Yeah, there we go.
1549. But by which point, the reference itself clearly makes... It seems to infer that people would already know this song, so it's possible that it's older.
Yes.
And then a fragment of the lyrics first turn up in something called the Ancient and Modern Scots Songs in 1769.
Right, okay.
And then, of course, we've talked a little bit about Francis Child, who had apparently 14 versions. Not apparently, there are 14 versions in his book. But what interested me quite a lot about this is that there seem to be very few examples of a sort of oral collection of it until about the 1930s.
Yeah.
In Connecticut.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
And you know, you it seems, if it's such a great ballad and such a huge ballad, why was people like Sharp not finding it?
Well, here is the missing link with that. Tamlin is also a ballad that people, one of those ones that people includes being such beautiful words, such amazingly structured words that are so skillfully done. And they use it as an example of how an oral tradition has produced this really well-crafted thing. But I have heard reference that the version of Tamlin, the set of words that most people use for Tamlin, is heavily edited by Robert Burns.
Right, okay.
At which point you go, oh, that's why, because that's why Robert Burns is still known for being an amazing poet and songwriter and author.
He had a talent.
He had a talent. The same with Sir Walter Scott. There's lots of ballads that turn out to be maybe an old story that are put into verse by Walter Scott.
Mm.
So I think there are probably people who've had their hands on this stuff, and that's when they become popular, because somebody has come along and, you know, and you can see that that process even to now, that something that probably wasn't that widespread gets rewritten by Aeneas Mitchell, and all of a sudden you hear it in every folk club.
Absolutely.
5 years later.
Yeah.
You know, so and that goes, and Fairport, and going back through the ages, that's always happened, I think. It takes somebody to make sense of this.
Yeah.
And it's hard. It's really hard to do.
Janet sits in her lonely room, sewing a silken seam, looking out on Carter Hall among the roses green. And Janet sits in her lonely bower, sewing a silken thread, and long to be in Carter Hall among the roses red.
So, as I say, I don't want to preempt it, but the thing about the Mike Watterson version of it is that it's technically very hard to sing. Mm. It takes a huge amount of performance skill to do it, and it's a huge amount of sort of technical skill to have put that together. And that's why it's seminal, because he was good at that. And you know, so I like it because it's not, because it's an example of somebody at the top of their game doing the absolute best they could.
And so, and I was actually, do you know a chap called Piers Corley?
Yes.
Up in, he's an unaccompanied ballad singer from up Doncaster way.
Yeah.
I was chatting to him earlier today, actually, and he was saying that he always thinks that Tamlin is a kind of barometer. So if you hear someone attempting Tamlin and they actually pull it off.
Yeah.
The rest of the canon is going to be peanuts to them.
just skipping back to a thing you said. No, I've never recorded this song, and that's why.
Right, you don't think
you
could do it.
Oh, I will. But one of the things that got me about folk music in the first place is that the reason this became my life instead of just being a thing I listened to.
Yeah.
Is at the time I played drums in bands, in sort of indie bands, like post Britpop-y bands.
Mm-hmm.
And I just realised that folk music is a genre where you can keep getting better. And the people I thought were really good were probably, you know, June Tabor when she was in her late 50s, early 60s at that point. You know, the Martin Carthys of the world.
Mm.
And you just, this idea that it doesn't, you know, you're not on the scrap heap when you're when you're the wrong side of 25. I suppose Tamlin is one that I have a lot of time to tackle.
Mm.
And it, like Frankie Armstrong, if it takes 30 years to think it through, you know, I'm happy with that, and I'm comforted by that.
Yeah, yeah.
So no, I haven't recorded it, but it's one that I'm really interested in.
Would you do it unaccompanied? Or
I don't know.
You don't know.
I mean, ask me in another 20 years' time, I suppose, if I'm halfway through that journey. Maybe. I don't know. It's hard to beat the Mike Watterson version for unaccompanied singing, and it's quite hard to beat the Fairport one for electric instruments on a traditional song.
I'm going to say it again, but let's come back to that. What I want to quickly pick apart is what the narrative of the song is.
Yes.
So if you haven't heard Tamlin before, what are you getting into? You're getting into shape-shifting fairy queens.
So you're getting into shape-shifting fairy queens. but also, I think the thing that's the saving grace, because I'm not a big fan of the goblins and fairies type of stuff.
Mm.
Tolkien-y side of stuff, it doesn't appeal to me.
Mm.
But this song gets a free pass because that's not really what it's about.
Mm.
It's about, I suppose it depends on what version, because also I think of the song this way, and then listening back to some recordings of it this morning, it's notable how different versions have entire chunks of lyrics missing and don't have that implication. Mm. The basic plot, I would say, is a lady who's called either Janet or Margaret in the two big towering versions that we're talking about. It feels a compulsion to go to the woods, to Carterhaugh, which is a place in Scotland, to the woods. And while she's there, she's picking some flowers and she's accosted by somebody and she doesn't know who they are. Who says, how dare you come and pick these flowers? This is my place. You're not allowed to come in here.
Yeah.
And she says, well, my father owns it. So I'm allowed to do whatever I want.
Mm.
And then at some point, well, in Mike Watson's words, what they did, I just couldn't say.
Mm-hmm.
But it results in Janet or Margaret becoming pregnant.
I wonder what now, they must most have done.
most of the versions, most of the traditional versions, or most, we'll come on to that. most of the versions say he never once asked her leave.
Right.
So that implies to me that there's it's about a rape,
right? Yeah.
As a lot of folk songs tend to be. But anyway, she goes back to the court. One of the servants in the court, one of her father's maids, spots that she's with child and advises her to get rid of it.
Mm.
So she goes back down to the woods to pick some herbs to induce an abortion, basically. And the same old voice, a tap on the shoulder comes, and the same old voice says, "How dare you pick those herbs?"
Right.
Now, this is the bit that with a sort of 2019, 2020 by the time this comes out, but, absolutely, you know, our sensibility now, this is the bit that's that this as of this morning has started to sit a little bit less comfortably with me, because I suppose I hadn't thought about it in that depth for a decade or so. So he persuades her not to take these herbs to induce the baby to be aborted, and then says, because the Queen of the Fairies is after me, because he turns out to be half human, half fairy man who was abducted from the human world and is being kept prisoner by the fairy court. But this, the actions of this happen on Halloween, when there is a fairy procession. Stay with this.
Yes.
When there is a fairy procession, and he has a chance to escape and come to the mortal world and raise their child together.
Right.
But in order to escape, a succession of horses in different colours, which feels to me like a reference to the sort of 12 horsemen of the apocalypse.
Okay.
Do you know the... We're going off at tangent. But do you know the band Aphrodite's Child? Demis Roussos was the singer in Aphrodite's Child, and Vangelis, who wrote the theme to Chariots of Fire and everything. In the 60s, they were in this really good Greek prog rock band that's really over the top. But their biggest song is about the horsemen of the apocalypse.
Okay.
And the chorus is about the different colours of horses. So the first horse is white and the second one is green.
Okay.
The third one is blue.
Yeah.
But yes, different colours of horses charge past him.
Yeah.
And the Queen of the Fairies is going to turn him into a succession of things as a test.
Yeah.
And his instructions are that Janet or Margaret has to hold him tight. He says, "Hold me tight and fear me not." So he's turned into a snake and a roaring lion and a red hot bar of iron in some versions. And it's a test. As long as she's not afraid of him, she'll be able to take him back to the mortal world. So there is this test that they eventually pass, and he's free to enter the human world and raise their baby together. But
so it's an exercise in realism then.
Yeah, in a sort of metaphorical sense, there's lots of stuff that you can get out of that.
Yeah.
So I suppose it illustrates a way that folk song depends on what you put into it. You know, it's all about interpretation. It's like those productions of Shakespeare where they set them in the Iraq War. Or whatever. The words are like a blank canvas. For you to impose some meaning on the top. And that's what these ballads are like.
Yeah.
They're a framework for which you can put your own meaning in with all of the phrasing and the inflections and the weighting you put on bits and how you pace the story. So I suppose this song can be a pro-choice thing, because it's Margaret decides that she doesn't want to raise the child on her own, and she's free to get rid of it, and that without any shame. You could see it that way.
You could
see it as I suppose it would still be the same message, but if we're assuming that Tamlin has raped her, and then when she comes to try and get rid of it, says, "No, you're not allowed to do that without my permission," because there is also this implication that he's got so angry because she's picking flowers in his wood without his permission. So I suppose you could see it as a sort of authoritarian, patriarchal, you know, thing that she's trying to. So I don't know how you then square this with this sort of love story at the end of as long as you hold me tight and don't and fear me not. You could see it in that way of, you know, the power of love to transcend stuff.
Yeah.
There's various interpretations you could put on it.
Mm.
That's I think what takes 30 years of grappling.
Yeah, absolutely.
To get to the point.
And you know, I mean, there are other folk songs where you get to the end of it. I'm going to have to look this up, and I'll put it in the notes connected to the podcast. But I chatted to Martin Carthy a couple of years ago about which was the song? Prince Heathen, it was. Yeah,
right. Okay.
And he couldn't square the ending.
Yeah.
And so he had to do something about it.
Yeah.
And actually change it himself. Yeah.
Well,
which is allowed.
It's very much allowed. And therein lies, I think, one of the lessons from Tamlin. In the Child Ballads, there are... did you say there was 15 for
14,
this one?
14, I think. 14, I read.
Okay. Yeah. For some of them, there's sort of 6 or 7, up to, you know, 15 versions of ballads. And some will be in Scots language. Some will be incomplete. Some will be very old-fashioned fragments, you know, that don't make sense. And when you look at a ballad like this, you have to edit it down and make something singable.
Yes, of course. Otherwise, you'd be there all night.
In a folk revival, second folk revival sense, all of my heroes were the people who were... So Martin Carthy, Nick Jones, Mike Waterson, are the people that had the editor's pen and were really skilled at doing that.
Yes.
So it's not... There is this sort of weird feeling in folk music of, you know, oh, you're not allowed to change it sometimes, which has just never been true.
Mm.
Even to the extent of this set of word A for this ballad seems to have been... put together by Robert Burns, like I say.
Yeah.
So it's always needed somebody to come along and do that to make it singable.
Absolutely.
So yeah, it's not just allowed. I think it's vital. It's really vital to the process.
Yes.
And that's the thing that I sort of hold as the great goal of being, you know, that's what I aspire to be. I don't want to be somebody that sings something, that picks something up and is too overly reverent with it. I want to be somebody that makes things better for my use.
Yes.
And then pass it on responsibly.
Yeah.
You know, be honest about what you've changed and what editing you've done, which is something that some of those sort of folk revival people didn't, because I think they were scared maybe.
Yeah,
of,
I would think that.
You know, or it, they thought it took away the mysticism to go, oh, I made half of this up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Instead of being proud and saying, I have, you know, here is my contribution to it. And
yeah.
And, you know, take that and do you know, take it on from that point.
Sure. I've been talking a lot to people over the last couple of days in recording these podcasts about this idea that the folk singer is essentially a sort of vessel by which that song travels through the period of time that folk singer is alive.
But it's not a passive process, is what I'm saying.
Yeah,
it's,
and that's
this,
a really
none
interesting...
None of this is a passive process.
Yeah.
There is a really vital thing in folk songs, so I guess we should make the distinction between songs and ballads at this point.
Okay.
So a ballad in a folk sense is a song that tells a story, usually in the third person.
Okay.
And folk songs are usually ones that are in the first person and are about a sort of smaller scale, feelings.
So,
well, it's somebody else's classification, but
I
think
great
it's useful.
Yeah.
So that Nick Jones album, Ballads and Songs.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Yeah,
Some song. There's some ones that are you're sort of as I walked out one morning in May, I saw a maiden and I approached her to whatever. That model of songs. And then there's stuff like Tamlin or Lord Bateman or
and of course Robin Hood comes
from Robin Hood
tradition, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Musically then, so we've had a look at what Tamlin is from a lyrical perspective and a little bit of the history. The music is interesting because we as a modern audience, as we said at the beginning, you come to it largely through a popular recording of it. So for most people, I think they probably come across it through Fairport Convention's version, which I think you just said is 50 years old this year. Is that right?
Yeah, 1969.
Yeah. So it was on an album called Legion Leaf. And, you know, if you haven't heard it, you just shouldn't be listening to this podcast, really. You should be going to listen to that.
Yeah, pause the podcast and go and listen to
it. What did I read? That they had sort of like, they played time games in it or something, in which the band are sort of pulling and...
So
go on, Professor, tell me about it.
Right, okay. So when you put electric instruments to traditional songs, you know, if there's one thing that's been my life up to this point's work, it's how you put drums to traditional songs.
Yeah.
Because marrying that popular music, sort of rock and roll, blues based, with jazz based, in fact, let's take it from there. idea of drumming has an accent on 2 and 4 of a 4/4 bar. It has a backbeat, right?
4.
Traditional music quite often is front loaded on the 1 of the bar.
Okay.
So it's that thing of, you know, that thing of people clapping on the first beat of the bar. So it's really awkward. So it's how you marry those two things.
Yeah.
And there are different ways of doing that for an electric recording of traditional music.
Right.
But a lot of this comes from Legion Leaf. And it works on Legion Leaf in a way that it doesn't work with some folk rock because of Dave Mattox, the drummer, who came from he was playing for tea dances and stuff. And he came from a jazz background because he wasn't very old. None of them were very old. Simon Nicol was, I think, 19 or 20 when they were making Legion Leaf. Wow. Richard Thompson is maybe a year, 2 years older. Ashley Hutchings, the bass player, is maybe 3 or 4 years older.
Yeah.
You know, but they're all under 25. Yeah, no, and so Dave Mattox, I think, was probably 21 at this point. Mm. But he'd been playing for tea dances.
Mm.
So how to make rhythm swing and not feel awkward and not draw attention to it, to support the song without drawing attention to it. So the genius of Tamlin, they sing it sort of in 3/4 with odd bars of 4/4.
Yeah.
So the pattern for a verse of Tamlin, as Sandy Denny sings it with Fairport Convention, is 3/4, 4/4, 3/4, 3/4.
Yeah.
And that repeats. The riff in between all the verses. The
sure.
You could see it's 2 bars of 3, or a set of 4 and then 2 beats, or 3 sets of 2 beats.
And as a band, would they all know what they're seeing that at?
I think they probably would, but it's far easier to demonstrate than it is to describe.
Yeah, yeah.
But the drums all happen on the first bit. He's doing a slide stick on every beat of the bar.
Right.
So you've got, I forbid you maidens all, rather than,
trying
to marry that.
Mm.
So the genius of it is this changing time signature. It doesn't matter because so Martin Carthy has this thing that I always took at face value of he used to describe songs as being in 1/4.
1/4, right.
And then when I actually eventually got around to asking him about it, it turned out it was a joke. He was like, oh, it's a thing I say I'd always taken that completely at face value. And I take 1/4 as being, if in a 4/4 or 3/4 bar, some beats are more important than others. In classical music, we talk about upbeats and downbeats.
Mm.
1/4 would mean every beat is the downbeat.
Right.
So every bar, every beat is accented.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what he's doing in Tamlin. That's what the drums are doing in Tamlin.
Yeah.
Every beat is a snare drum beat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then the rhythm section, the guitars and the bass are marking the first beat of every bar. And when there's a 4/4 bar, they do the 4th beat as well. So it goes duh, 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 like that.
Yeah.
In these bursts. But it means that the vocal then, a thing that in an a cappella world, you know, in an unaccompanied world, wasn't designed to have an accompaniment that keeps it in rigid time, can float over the top.
Yes.
And that's something I've come back to in my own stuff. That's something I've come back to quite a lot, of trying to marry stuff that floats over the top of an even pulse.
Right. Okay.
So there was a period of Eliza Carthy's recording the album Anglicana.
Yeah.
An idea that she was obsessed with at the time was trying to make the instruments follow the vocal, not the other way around. So if she wants to slow down a bit or have a pause, all of the instruments pause at that point.
Right, okay.
So there are tracks on that record where the instruments are constantly, they play a few bits and then they all pause together. And that's her way of
dealing
with that. The other one that was influential on me is the Nick Jones way, which is you have something that's very rhythmic and marks a pulse.
Yeah.
And then the vocal floats over the top and sometimes it falls behind. And that's where my tastes lie, I think.
Yeah.
But Tamlin is a really good example of this genius.
Yeah.
Everything is so rhythmic.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter that the time signatures are changing because the vocal happens in its own time. And when it comes to an important bit, it coincides.
Mm. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
I would never have been able to strip that down and work out what's going on there.
So that's what's happening in that. I mean, also, some of the verses are slightly longer than others in that there might be 1 or 2 more syllables, and that allows you to do that. That allows you to use the poetic word that has two more syllables than the previous verse had in that position.
Yeah.
That's not uncommon in
traditional song, is it?
No, it's really not.
Yeah, I remember, talking to Eliza Carthy about this and about how performing in Waterson Carthy, they would just follow Norma whenever Norma decided to throw something in. Or
Waterson Carthy, I think, those records are really underrated now. Maybe it's just the period when I was starting performing, when they were at their peak, maybe. But those records, I think, are amongst the best that Eliza's ever made, and amongst the best that Martin's ever made. You know, and they kind of get dwarfed by the solo catalogues of Norma and Martin and Eliza. Yeah. But those records, I would put up there as being
some of the best
amazing examples of how you do
traditional music,
folk song. Yeah,
absolutely.
So the Fairport one, melodically, I can't work out where that melody comes from. Going back to this theme of the more you scratch away at the background, the more things become less certain.
Yeah.
I can't find any reference to where she got that tune from, Sandy Denny got that tune from. And some of the things on Legion Leaf, it's regarded as being the first English folk rock record, but there's very little English stuff on there. It's Scottish or American.
Right, okay.
So Matty Groves, the other big towering track on Legion Leaf, comes from a version by Gene Ritchie, the Appalachian dulcimer player and singer. Okay. I don't know where the tune for Tamlin comes from, but hazarding a guess, I think they made it up. I think maybe Dave Swarbrick and her made it up, probably based on something else. Dave Swarbrick, the fiddle player, was very good at coming up with things that would sound... There's a song on Legion Leaf called Crazy Man Michael.
Yes.
That sounds like a traditional air because he was so immersed in it and from working with Martin Carthy.
Yeah.
That he could come up with tunes that you can't see the joins.
Yes, absolutely.
So I wonder whether this tune is one of his because I can't find any reference to anybody who knows where that tune is from.
And it becomes obvious. I know you said this morning when you were on your way here, you had a little playlist of Tamlins, and so did I. I was sitting reading my emails, listening to 5 or 6 versions of Tamlin this morning.
Yeah,
and that does stand out as being.
Yeah,
you can see the links between all the other tunes and how everybody else is singing it.
So all of the other tunes can be traced to this source of Bert Lloyd. So Bert Lloyd was. I think I'm right in saying he was one of the founders of Topic Records.
Okay.
He certainly was the director of Topic for a big chunk of the 50s and an activist and by the sounds of it, an encourager.
Yeah.
Martin Carthy once described him as being, there would be other people who'd sing a song and you'd go, I love that song. I'd love to sing it. And they would sort of shut down and, you know, you're not having it. It's mine. And Bert Lloyd would have already handwritten out a couple of extra copies because he knew people would want that. So he'd just reach into his shirt pocket and go, here you go, son, and give Martin the set of words because that's what he was like because he wanted to spread it. So
I think a lot of people perhaps coming to traditional music for the first time know him in conjunction with the name Ewan McColl, right?
Yes, they do. Yeah. So he also was a Communist Party member and his interest in folk music, I think, had political things behind it. He thought that the music of the working man was important to be preserved and had an agenda in the sort of post-Second World War world. He thought that it was an important tool for making people be in touch with their history.
Yeah.
So there was big political agenda. So going back to what we were saying about folk song collectors having an agenda when they were going out to collect stuff, you also have this 1950s, 60s agenda to untangle as well.
Yeah.
And especially so because Bert Lloyd had an interesting life. He'd lived in Australia for a bit. He was a sheep shearer for a bit. And he worked on board a whaling vessel. And he came back to Britain with lots of Australian songs and whaling songs and so on. Some of which are real, some of which aren't.
But he made them up himself.
He was a... I think it might have been Martin Simpson who I was talking to about this, about people in various eras of folk music history who have got that sort of Bob Dylan-y, you know, he invented a backstory and it was based on truth, but it was very unclear which experiences were real and which ones were tall tales.
Yes.
And that goes for all of his songs as well. I think one of the quintessential examples is the song Renadine, which has links to various sort of Germanic legends.
Yeah, it's another vast ballad, isn't it?
Another vast ballad. Yeah. So Professor Child was quite into Scandinavian folklore and you know, other European folk traditions and would link stuff in. So Renadine comes from the same root as there's a Webern opera Weber or Webern, I can't remember which. This is 20 years since I did my degree, called Bluebeard's Castle.
Right.
But Renadine follows largely the same plot. The difference is, in England, people largely think about it as him being a sort of werefox, a man who can change into a fox. And that is an invention of Bert Lloyd,
right,
who inserted a couple of lines, who just saw the similarity in names and went, oh, wouldn't it be really good if he was a werefox? And inserted this thing about his bright eyes did shine, sly, bold Renadine.
And his
teeth were gleaming. And that's all inserted by Bert Lloyd.
Yeah.
And that pattern follows through. There's lots of things that are folk club standards that turn out. You can trace them back to this one guy who said, I got this from an old gentleman.
Right.
You know, that these new versions have come to light, but no one's ever seen the sources. When he died and they went through his archives, no trace of them.
But there's an element of timing here, isn't there? Because you've got, you know, Bert Lloyd, as I understand it, sort of starts to appear in the folk music story in the late 50s, early 60s. And of course, by the mid 60s, you've got the interest in traditional English music or traditional British music clashing up against, I suppose, I mean, it's what might be called sort of early hippie interests in the esoteric in Tam Lin. I mean, it's quite interesting that you've got, we've talked about the Fairy Queen, and we're not, by no means are we talking about some, you know, sort of dancing light nymph. Fairy, or the beginning of the word fairy, fair, is medieval French for magical creature.
Oh, is it?
So,
I didn't know that.
And magical creature,
that's amazing,
could have been anything, and quite often was malevolent.
Right,
so we're not talking about like dancing flowers and stuff like that. We're talking, well, as we've said, we're talking about something a lot more sinister than that.
So you know, again, with a 2019 head on, you could interpret that as being, it's code for the other.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's another.
Absolutely.
So that thing we were saying about this sort of early nationalist feeling before it all went bad.
Yeah.
This sort of gentle othering of people.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It can be.
Yeah, I can see
it
that.
Could be seen in those terms.
Absolutely. And I mean, again, for non-folkies sort of coming to things like this for the first time, you know, while you've said, and I totally agree with you, I've never been a fan of The Hobbit, I've never been a fan of Tolkien and that sort of thing, and I was always slightly put off. But I know a lot of people who love things like Led Zeppelin.
Well, this is the thing.
And you can make an easy jump between Fairport through Sandy Denny to Led Zeppelin and then to Aleister Crowley, and then you're talking about all kinds of dark malevolence.
Just going on my dad's experience, I think there was a big crossover of people interested in folk music, folk clubs.
Mm.
We're probably talking late 60s, early 70s at this point. Mm. And Tolkien, there was a big resurgence in interest in Tolkien in the late 60s.
Well, yeah, you can hear it.
And it also crosses over with another guy I've worked with who's called Chris Foster, who's a big influence on me.
Mm.
He's he lives in Iceland now, but Somerset folk singer and guitarist. Said that there was also definitely a strain of people who wanted some more depth than ABBA or Shawaddy Waddy, you know, there was a getting into folk music because somehow it represented more. It was a reaction against something rather than purely a reaction for something else.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Of course, yeah.
So some of the motivation was going, this music is better than that music.
Yeah.
Or this has way more worth than that music. Mm. It wasn't purely a, wow, this music has captivated me.
Yeah.
There was also a, I feel so much better than this.
A snobbery, perhaps.
Yeah. So, and I think those things, I think those interests all on the Venn diagram all overlap to make songs like this be prominent.
Yes.
Because they cater to lots of different interests.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go to...
Well, we were talking about Bert Lloyd.
Oh, sorry.
Which brings us... it brings us on to the Mike Watterson version, because I think this is probably one of the benchmark performances of how to do a long ballad. It's over 10 minutes long, and it never gets boring.
Hmm.
And that's really hard.
Absolutely.
So the tune for this is the Bert Lloyd tune.
Come all you maids, and you very pretty maids, and a warning take by me. Don't go down to the chaser's wood. If a maid you want to return and return, if a maid you want to return, Lady Margaret, Lady Margaret, she was sitting in her bower. She was red as any rose, but she longed to go to the chaser's wood to pull them flowers that grows and grows. Oh, to pull the flowers that grows.
The interesting thing about this tune that stood out for me before I read up a bit more on where this tune had come from, I think I presumed it must be from a manuscript or something. But there is an odd thing in it. So the tune is simultaneously in the harmonic minor scale
meaning?
And the Aeolian mode.
Wow, like Latin. So,
yeah.
or Greek,
so how deep into modes should we go?
Let's touch on it lightly so okay. that people can right. understand so, what you're talking about.
So one of the things people talk about with folk song is that they're modal tunes.
Meaning?
And well, exactly. That is that in some ways that's quite a meaningless.
Oh, okay.
That's quite a meaningless thing to say. What people take by modal tunes is that they have different notes contained within the scale. So a major scale that you'd know, do 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 do, that is an Ionian scale.
Yep.
And there are seven modes. So if you imagine those laid out on a piano from the white notes from C to C, Ionian major scale, C major scale will just be all the white notes.
Yep.
If you then played all the white notes starting on D, that's a Dorian mode.
Right.
Which is what the Fairport Tamlin is in.
Right.
So Dorian mode is a minor mode with a flattened seventh.
Okay.
And a and an ordinary perfect fourth in it,
right?
And then you go through all the modes. There are seven modes. Major scale wise, Ionian would be the most common, probably. A lot of folk songs are in Mixolydian mode, starts on the fifth degree of the scale.
Okay.
It's the fifth mode. So that's a major scale, but with a flattened seventh.
Yep.
Which is important for a reason I'll tell you in a second.
Okay.
But then the other two are Dorian and Aeolian are the main minor modes.
Yeah.
And they both have a flattened seventh.
Okay.
So when we talk about folk songs being modal, what's actually meant by that is songs that were designed to be sung a cappella tell you what the chords should be underneath.
Right, okay.
So my argument is that modes don't exist in a vacuum. They only exist because there is an implied harmony underneath it.
Right, I see.
So what a flattened or sharpened seventh does is it determines the character of the five chord.
The five.
So the most important primary chords, the one chord, the tonic chord.
Which would be C if we're talking.
In C it would be C.
Yeah.
The subdominant, which would be F, which is number four.
Yeah.
And G, which is the dominant.
Fifth. Yeah.
And the fifth is the most important chord other than the tonic. The whole time. So with a flattened seventh, that's a minor chord.
Mm-hmm.
And with a sharpened seventh, that's a major chord.
Okay.
So this Burt Lloyd tune for Tamlin oscillates between the harmonic minor mode, which has a sharpened seventh.
Okay.
Which means that the five chord is a major chord.
Yeah.
In a minor scale.
Yeah.
And the Aeolian mode, which means it's a minor chord.
Mm.
So when he's descending, it descends down to what we'd call a dominant seventh chord, which is a very sort of strong, austere-sounding chord in a minor scale. And when he's ascending, he goes up via the minor, minor dominant chord. So that was like, why is that the case in a traditional tune? Which isn't to say that those things probably are common. And a lot of those things got evened out by folk song collectors, assuming the singer had got it wrong.
Right, okay.
Sometimes. But on the other hand, if you were going to write a song to sound as folky as possible, that's the sort of thing you might put in to make it sound more modal in inverted commas.
Yeah, yeah.
The best guess is that it's based on the tune for a song called Let No Man Steal Your Time.
Yeah.
And if you know that, there's a June Tabor recording of it that I really like.
Okay.
Various other people have recorded it. It's the same tune. It's the same tune with some minor differences, but it doesn't have that sharpened or flattened seventh bit in it.
Okay.
I think that's a Burt Lloyd invention.
Come all you fair and tender girls that flourish in your bright. Beware, beware, keep your guard and bear. Let no man steal your time. Let no man steal
But yes, so Bert Lloyd, I think, has made this tune up based on the another traditional tune that he's altered to fit.
Right.
But I think he claimed that he'd got this from some source, and he wouldn't tell me, you know. I've got this from a very old man, but I can't tell you where, and I've got no record, and I can't prove it ever happened. But yeah, that's the tune that's sort of taken root everywhere else, probably, but I mean, through Bert Lloyd's influence, because I think he probably gave it to Frankie Armstrong and Mike Waterson and Anne Briggs, who's also recorded it.
Young Tambling,
yeah. But still, I think he gave it to them when he'd done more work on it than he was letting on.
Right, okay. Interesting theory. So my introduction to this song comes directly from, like most people, from Fairport Convention version. And then maybe a couple of years ago, I first heard Mike Waterson's version.
Yeah.
And it's towering.
It's towering.
How do you describe Mike Waterson's version? I mean, we are talking about an 11-minute rendition of a song.
Yeah.
At least.
Yeah.
I mean, the important thing is that he holds your attention for 11 minutes.
Yes.
And how does he do that?
Well, there's an idea that I'm really fascinated with, that I've been on this tip for quite a while.
Right.
When you learn screenwriting or like writing films or whatever, there are loads of books and courses and stuff on how to do this.
Yeah.
But they teach you about a three-act structure.
Okay.
And they teach you to hit certain points at certain points in the film. So if you've got a two-hour film, you have 45 minutes of sort of... I suppose this is a bit similar to classical music forms as well, of this idea of exposition. So you have 45 minutes of establishing things and setting something up. And then you have 45 minutes of development, where you play with expectations, where a third of the way through the film, something happens that pulls the ground from under your feet. And then you have a bit where your characters have to deal with that, right? And then you have a recapitulation at the end, in classical music terms, where your characters have to sort out all through the loose ends, and maybe it's a bit tense, but you're heading for some sort of resolution. I think the best performances of folk songs definitely do that. It's the pacing that's the incredible technical genius in that Mike Waterson version, that he holds your attention because, you know, if you break it down into blocks of three or four verses, every time a little segment finishes, it leaves you on a cliffhanger, and you know, I suppose it's probably the same as writing a drama or a series, that at the end of your episode of EastEnders, you have to have a cliffhanger so the drummers duff bit. That I think is what's going on there. There's something about editing, cutting away all the dead wood, but sometimes there's also adding more padding so that you can leave the verse on a cliffhanger.
Yeah, and you're saying that's what he's done with this.
I don't know. I mean, that's what I do with songs, and that's what I'm taking from his version of it. Anyway, that's the bit where taking that version of Tamlin as a learning thing to apply to my own work.
But when you're talking about sort of taking some of the dead wood and adding the padding, you're not necessarily taking lines or lyrics away. You might be talking about sort of almost in an emotional sense, right? So
yeah, but quite often it is taking lines away. Right, that is what I'm talking about.
Right,
making it have the right amount of syllables so that when you reach the payoff point of the tune, you also reach a payoff point of the lyrics.
Right. Okay.
There is a lot of this stuff that is like doing a crossword.
Yeah.
You know, that is sort of word games.
Yeah.
Which is why somebody like Alistair Roberts, I don't know if you've talked to Alistair.
I've not.
Right, okay. Well,
I should.
I look forward to that.
Okay.
Alistair is a really interesting man. But I once watched him do a crossword in about 30 seconds flat. I don't know whether he knew that I was watching over his shoulder, but he can just look at a clue and go and then write it in, and he can rearrange things in his brain. He's really good at word games. He's really good at words. You know, that skill is the same skill he applies to songwriting and song editing, I think. So there is a part of the folk song editor's brain that is just technical agility with words, I think, and a technical agility with sentences. But there's also something about when folk singers talk about singing in your own voice, this is something else I find fascinating, because quite often that's a byword for the opposite of what they're actually saying.
Right, okay.
In folk music, sometimes when we talk about singing in your own voice, that's used as code for being, they're putting on the voice of what the folk singer should sound like.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I know what you mean.
So, and also,
Martin,
I think
Carthy famously had a period where he did that himself.
Yeah, and I think there is a certain sort of fetishization of being untouched, if you know what I mean. Like, right. This is completely natural, and I haven't worked on it at all. Mm. And this is, I think it probably taps right back to that folk song collecting. One of the agendas that they had was they wanted to find people untouched by civilization almost. Mm. It's like uncontacted tribes.
Yeah.
So Cecil Sharp cycling out to these villages were places where the Industrial Revolution hadn't reached and ruined everything.
Yes.
You know, people so untainted by modernity.
Again.
So there is still this sort of fetishization of, I'm from a place and I sing in a regional accent and I'm completely untutored and this is my natural voice, right? But quite often that is... you have to work really hard to sing like that.
Yeah.
So Mike Watson is a good example of that's not, you know, and this is not taking anything away from him because I mean this in a good way. This is what I admire about it. Mm. Mike Watson is not somebody who just opened his mouth and sounded like that. Mm. He's tried really hard to sound like that, and he's practiced and he's got better at doing it. So he has constructed what he wants to sound like, and that goes for the word choices. And pronunciation of words and his accent and how he
did
sings.
Right, because otherwise, you know, he's again somebody coming to traditional music for the first time is you come across when you reach Mike Watson, as you inevitably do, you're first struck by his what you can only really describe as vocal gymnastics, his ability to leap
bits.
And yelp and
yeah,
stuff
there's
like
lots
that.
Of bits in early Watsons that are like. Extra vocal noises,
yeah,
like, you know, they're singing a harmony and then the break before the next line there's a sort of yelp in the background.
Yeah And but without it,
yeah,
the ear is not drawn, well, the ear is naturally drawn to what they're doing because it's beautiful, but the ear is particularly drawn in,
yeah,
and then there's all sorts of questions. Why is that man doing that?
Yeah,
why do I like the fact that he's doing that?
But I've been thinking about this as well in terms of stand-up
comedy.
You think
a lot about these things.
Yeah,
did you,
I don't,
did you lie
well,
awake
I don't,
at night?
I haven't had much of a life other than thinking about folk song. So this is the only thing I'm any good at. But in stand-up comedy, there are people who rise above the sort of surface noise by constructing a whole world. Where when you come and see them, you enter their world, if you know what I mean. And so I suppose a current one would be James Acaster, the comedian, where when you go and see James Acaster, you sort of know his worldview and he's able to do anything because you've entered his little
universe.
Yes, I see
what you mean.
Stuart Lee's a bit like that as well.
Yeah.
But Mike Watson, I would say, is the musical equivalent of he worked really hard to curate his musical world.
Yes.
And then once you're in it, he, you know, you're putty in his hands, really.
He can do
anything with that because he's set some ground rules that are entirely his. His way of singing and his way of phrasing things.
Did you know him? Did you meet him?
I did meet him. I didn't know him. He didn't perform very much in the time I've been performing.
Right,
he was always around.
Yeah.
You know, and he was at Sidmouth a lot when I was a child and a young adult. His family, him and Lal... Mm-hmm. Lal Watson always had jobs. He was a painter and decorator.
Absolutely,
he did some building stuff. So no, I didn't really know him. I mean, I knew him to say hi to, but in the context of being Eliza's uncle or Norma's brother or Martin's brother-in-law.
Yeah.
And also I think he was generally quite chatty. He would chat to anybody. So it wasn't anything special about me. It was that
he
would chat to anybody who was in the room
just
with him.
Just a nice guy.
But yeah, incredible songwriter, but really understated. On that, I mean, I think other people. I think he has a great reputation as a songwriter. I'm not saying he probably is underappreciated even then.
Well, again, this is about taking yourself out of the. So Jim and I discussed this a few weeks ago when we met up about how, you know, when you're new to the folk world, you find that people make a lot of assumptions that you have to learn about in order to access that world.
Yeah.
So I think. As somebody relatively new, I mean, I'm only sort of 3 or 4 years into my traditional
into your
folk journey. Whereas I think you came Morris dancing out of the womb, from what I understand.
Well, sort of, yeah.
But, you know, my introduction, actually, one of my earliest introductions was because I knew a bit about Bright Phoebus, which is an album that I won't go into now, but it just has to be listened to if you can get a copy of it. Another whole big story. Yeah. But yes, you come across him and you don't. I mean, because we're talking about a very niche world here. He's huge within that niche world.
Yeah.
And the Watersons are huge within that niche world. And they cross over. And Martin Carthy, who's connected to that, of course, as a member of the Watersons, he does cross over it because he has the connection with having been a huge influence on the likes of Bob Dylan and Paul Simon and people like that. But Mike Watson, a little harder to access if you if you're coming fresh to it all.
I would recommend to anybody this film that was made for the BBC called Travelling for a Living.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah,
which is the film. 60s film. And at the time, the Watersons consisted of Norma Watson, who is later Martin Carthy's wife, her sister Lal, and her brother Mike. Mike and John, in this film, because they're, again, they're in their early 20s. Yeah, they're incredibly young. And they're travelling around in a van playing folk clubs. And they both have this sort of Billy Liar, you know, they look like anti-heroes. In
yeah, absolutely.
They look really, really cool. But,
yeah,
you know,
absolutely. It's like a sort of mob thing.
Mike Watson,
right?
With a like with a long fringe hanging over his face, smoking a cigarette, and he cut quite a figure. But yeah, very important, while at the same time never having been a household name or anything, and never having been sort of bogged down by that. So when the Watersons then performed throughout the 60s, split up, I don't know what year, but earlier than you'd think.
Yeah,
they weren't performing for
they
very
exhausted
long
themselves,
in the grand
didn't
scheme
they?
Things. They exhausted things. They went off and got jobs.
Yeah.
And they reformed to be occasional performers. I think they had a bout of like a longer run of performing in the 70s, but then they sort of petered out again. With John replaced by Martin Carthy at that point. So there are two sort of lots of seminal Watersons records, very early ones when they're young and they're really. Which I think was Burt Lloyd championing them, you know.
That's what, and
those first records, I think, were recorded in a day.
And the
Burt Lloyd behind the tape recorder.
It's Frost and Fire, isn't it?
Yeah, Frost and Fire.
Is the one. And then the second.
Second
is
lineup with For Pence and Spicy
For
Ale.
For Pence and Spicy Ale.
So Frost and Fire is a sort of calendar of seasonal songs, all of the seasons. But yeah, very influential and influential in lots of other ways because it all feeds out into people who did become more household names or did become prolific performers who are still performing now.
So let's go back to Tamlin.
Yes.
Because I'm going to come to the end of this conversation now. We've been chatting for ages.
Yes, sorry.
You and your experience of Tamlin, do you remember first hearing it?
I almost certainly the Fairport version.
Right.
I don't remember first hearing it. I don't have a mental image of when it would be. But Legion Leaf was one of those records that my dad would put on when we were having Sunday lunch. Tubular Bells, an 80s Albion Band album called Light Shining, which is a weird choice these days. Nick Jones records. Yeah. Below the Salt by Steel Ice Pan.
Right. Okay.
Legion Leaf. That's that sort of thing. He would put on a record while we were having Sunday lunch and then get up and turn it over and we'd listen to a record while we were eating.
Right. Nice.
So I'm going to guess that I first heard Tamlin then. But straight away I knew. I mean, that Legion Leaf is very influential on people outside the folk world because Richard Thompson's guitar playing is inspired.
Yeah, yeah.
The sort of fiddle playing that Dave Swarbrick's doing, that electric fiddle playing, I suppose the nearest precedent is the Velvet Underground.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But even then, that doesn't. It's not really in the same zone as John Cale in the Velvet Underground playing viola, and the drumming and the singing. You know, everybody and you know Simon Nicol being a very solid anchor of rhythm guitar as well, and the bass playing. But yeah, that I think it would have been Fairport that I first heard it.
And you've been obviously thinking about it a lot. Ever since, is it something that you come back to that you were
Tamlin specifically?
Yeah.
No, not really. I mean, my thinking about it is more of a general thinking about child ballads.
Yeah.
And reconciling all of these things. I mean, I suppose I come back again to that thing of folk singing and performing, and it's not a passive process. It's all an active process. Even that stuff of the folk song collectors deciding what to leave out as much as to collect in. It's a, you know, folk songs that become popular and become staples are differentiated from the ones that get left by the wayside by a democratic process of if people sing them they keep going. If people stop singing them, if they fall out of favor. So for instance, there are a whole load of fox hunting and whaling songs that nobody of my generation sings that will be footnotes at some point that were massive in the 60s and 70s. Because, you know, tastes change and the things that are universal to every age are the things that stay. So I really believe in that sort of democratic thing of it, but you know, like all democracy, it's not a passive process. Mm. It's not just you let it happen. You can make active choices here.
Mm.
So I suppose my thinking about folk song is untangling other people's agendas and trying to get down to what I actually think about stuff.
Of course, yeah.
Folk music isn't something where you fall in line and where you... I think newcomers are often put off by feeling like they're not qualified enough.
Mm.
Whereas the most qualified people to talk about it are the ones who go, I barely know anything.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
There's probably a sort of bell curve of...
Yeah.
As you learn more about it, you get more confident in your opinions and then you get less confident
really interesting,
the more you know.
Yeah.
I really feel that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it as a ballad, I think it's one of the great examples, and it's one that I would recommend to people.
Mm.
But it's a deep dive, you know, it's not an easy listening.
And I have tried that. Becoming interested in traditional music has been a wonderful thing in that it has introduced me to a lot of other nerds.
Yeah.
Yourself included, Jim.
Yeah.
Who I've grown to, you know, to like as friends and to sort of enjoy conversations with. And it's become it's a really lovely community to have joined. And once you're in through that door and you've got the bug, you're extremely welcomed. And, but on the flip side, I've had the experience quite a lot where I've and actually with Tamlin, where I've sent a copy of or I've sent a link to Mike Waterson's song to friends of mine who I think, you know, who love music.
Yeah.
And they just look at it and go, 11 minutes, are you kidding?
Yeah. It's a lot to take in.
And you know, and it's a hard thing to get to, but it's so rewarding.
I think very briefly where the folk scene as an industry and a sort of the commercial side of stuff has gone wrong is that they think that an audience will be attracted by dumbing down and making things simpler and getting rid of, I mean, again, we come back to getting rid of all of the nuance and getting rid of the messiness. Mm-hmm. But my friend Tim, our mutual friend Tim, is somebody where when he gets into music, he has to get into it 100%. Mm. So when he discovered Bob Dylan and decided he liked Bob Dylan, he bought 300 odd Bob Dylan books. And when he got into folk traditional music, he had to buy everything.
Yeah.
And he told me that he'd always known he'd like jazz.
Yeah.
But because he's quite an obsessive person about music, he was saving it until he was 40 to get into jazz. And then when he got into jazz, he had to buy every Blue Note record and so on. And I feel like folk music, traditional music, is best suited to those people.
Mm.
That it's actually about, it's music that you can enjoy on a musical level, but there's so much extra stuff. It's for the people who want to, you know, who want to immerse themselves in something, and it's a completely bottomless pool for interest. You know, I don't think it's well served by trying to make things simple or trying to make things easy, because there's no reward in easy stuff.
Yeah.
Folk music is hard. It's hard to sing and it's hard to play and it's hard to listen to sometimes. And it's hard to untangle what's true about things and what isn't. But that's what's amazing. That's why this is what I've done with my life.
Yeah.
And that's why I think this is probably what I'll do with the rest of my life.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Forever.
Well, thank you for your time today.
No, thank you so much for talking to me. It's a really great thing that you're doing.
And thank you. But I feel like we're an hour and a half into this, and I feel like we could keep going for another hour and a half.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear the other podcasts as well. I'm really interested to hear what other people have to say.
Well, I want you to come back and do another song. This is not going to be a podcast whereby everybody gets one turn.
Right, yeah.
I want to learn.
Okay.
And the best way to learn is to have someone like you sitting here and talking.
Well, yeah.
Great, thanks. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
Come all you mates and you very pretty maids, a warning take by me. Don't go down to the chaser's wood. If a maid you want to return, return. If a maid you want to return. Lady Margaret, Lady Margaret, she was sitting in a bower, as red as any rose, but she longed to go to the chaser's wood, to pull them flowers that grows, to pull the flowers that grows. And she's taken out her silver comb, in haste to comb her hair, Then she's away to the chaser's wood, as fast as she could tear, as fast as she could tear. And she had not pulled but one red rose, a rose that grows in the green. When a voice said, "Lady, how dare you pull that rose without no leave of me, of me? Without no leave of me." Well, this little wood, it is my very own. My father gave it to me. I will pull, pluck, break, I'll bend the branch, but I won't ask leave of thee, of thee. No, I won't ask leave of thee. Well, he's taken her by the middle so small, down to where the grass grows green. And what they've done, well, I just couldn't say, but the green grass grew between, between, the green grass grew between. He's taken her by the lily white hand, to where the grass grows green. And it's what they've done, well, I just couldn't say, but he's never once asked her leave, her leave. No, he's never once asked her leave. Well, 24 ladies, they were sitting in the hall, playing at the chess, all except for young Margaret. She's as green as any grass, she's as green as any grass. Well, up then spoke just one of them girls, and on her face there was a smile. She says, "I think my lady's loved a little long, and now she goes with child, and now she goes with child." And up and spoke another of them girls, a pretty girl was she. She says, "I know a herb growing in the chaser's wood that'll twine the babe from thee, it'll twine the babe from thee." Lady Margaret, she picked up her silver comb in haste to comb her hair. Then she's away to the chaser's wood, as fast as she could tear, as fast as she could tear. And she had not pulled but one bit of the herb it grew so fine. When up there spoke young Tamlin, saying, "Margaret, leave it alone, alone. My love, won't you leave it alone? Why would you want that bitter, bitter herb, the herb that grows so grey, except to twine away the pretty baby that we got in our play, that we got in our play?" "Oh, tell me this, young Tamlin," she says, "if a mortal man you be." "Well, I'll tell you the truth without no lie. I was christened as good as thee, I was christened as good as thee. But as I rode out on a bitter, bitter day, 'twas from my horse I fell, when the queen of the elves, she did take me away to the yonder green wood to dwell, to the yonder green wood to dwell. And it's every seventh year we pay a toll to hell, and the last one here is the first to go, and I fear the toll, it's myself, myself. This year the toll's myself. Tonight it is the Halloween, when the elven court shall ride. If you would your true lover save, in the old mill bridge you must hide, you must hide, in the old mill bridge you must hide. And it's first will come the black horse, and then there'll come the brown, and they're both raced by the white. You must throw your arms up around my neck, and I will not you affright, affright. No, I will not you affright. And they'll change me then. It's all in your arms, into the beast so wild. You must hold me tight, you must fear me not, for I'm the father of your child, I'm the father of your child. But the woods grew dark, the woods grew dim, and young Tamlin was gone. She's picked up her lily white feet, and to the mill bridge she has run, to the mill bridge she has run. She's looked high, she has looked low, encompassed all around, but nothing she saw, she nothing heard. She heard no mortal sound, no sound, she heard no mortal sound. Till about the deader of the night, she heard the bridles ring. It cheered her heart, it's given her a start, more than any mortal thing, anything, more than any mortal thing. Well, first came the black horse, and then there came the brown. They were both raced by the white, so she's thrown her arms up around his neck, and he didn't her affright, affright. No, he didn't her affright. And the thunder roared all across the sky, the stars burned bright as day, when the queen of the elven, she gave a shrieking cry, saying, young Tamlin is away, away, young Tamlin is away. So they changed him then, it was all in her arms, into a lion wild, but she held him tight, and she feared him not. He was the father of her child, she knew he was the father of her child. So they changed him again, it was all in her arms, to a big black hissing snake, but she held him tight and she feared him not. He was one of God's own make, she knew he was one of God's own make. And then they changed him again, it was all in her arms, to a big black dog to bite, but she held him tight and she feared him not, and he didn't her affright, affright. No, he didn't her affright. So they changed him again, it was all in her arms, to a white hot bar of iron, but she held him tight, she feared him not, and he did to her no harm, no harm, he did to her no harm. Then they've changed him again, it was all in her arms, to a naked man, and she throwed her cloak up upon his shoulders, saying, Tam of the Lynn, we've won, we've won, young Tam of the Lynn, we've won.
Thanks so much to Jim for that recording. It's, well, it's mind-blowing in many ways. I can't believe he actually did that, and he did that for this podcast. An exclusive there. Now, before we continue and tell you who our next guest is going to be, I'm just going to tell you a little about the discography from this episode. Right up front, you had Tamlin, taken from Lesion Leaf by Fairport Convention, 1969 on Island Records. Then you had Tamlin, Child 39, taken from Child Ballads, the album by Aeneas Mitchell and Jefferson Hamer, released in 2013 on Wilderland Records. Then we had Tamlin, so there was a theme here, wasn't there? Taken from Mike Waterson album by Mike Waterson, which was released in 1977 on Topic Records. After that, we had Let No Man Steal Your Time, taken from Angel Tiger by June Tabor, released in 1992 on Cooking Vinyl. Then we had, of course, Tamlin, as performed by Jim Murray himself, right here on this podcast. You heard it here first, folks. Now then, let me just tell you, next time I'm back, could be next week, could be next month, but next time it's definitely going to be Ben Walker, so make sure you tune in for that. Bye for now.